Yeah, so I'm going to start recording now, then you can have the session.
You doing fine in terms of
okay here. I mean, it's a little bit, we had a lot of bad cases last year and again in January. So January and February. But many of the cases are very elderly people that got infected in homes. And so it's generally not a big issue. I mean, it's not a generalized major problem, but it's for sure a stress on the health system and so on. But the government here counts every person who has COVID as dying with COVID, where like they might be 84 years old and have a heart condition. So they're just dying from whatever thing. But if they also have COVID, they're considered to be a COVID death. And so the death toll seems to be really high. And it's not as high as that. It's not the COVID that is like wiping out all these people. It's these comorbidities. And this is often the case in all kinds of countries. You see people who have problems with obesity or diabetes or, you know, other existing health conditions. And then this is just one more thing. And their body just says, I can't do this. But other people are able. I mean, it's not an easy disease, but other people are able to overcome and they don't certainly die from it. So I think the bigger priority is to get people to become healthy again, you know, that's get people to live in a way that's healthy and sustainable. So they're not just eating whatever they want and doing whatever they want with their life and then let the government figure it out when there's a problem. You know, this is where we've gone so wrong in our society. And this is literally the opposite of mindfulness, you know? So this is one great example of when we understand mindfulness, we understand that every single thing that we do affects other people. And it's not just people we know that it affects, but it affects people we don't know. It affects the whole balance of things. And so if we behave in such a way that's selfish and inconsiderate, at somewhere, you know, down the ripples, somebody has to pick up the slack. Somebody has to clean up the mess, as it were. And whatever that behavior is, it's going to lead to other consequences for other people. And so it's not like, it's not something that it's just a theory. It's something extremely practical. When you're fully mindful, you're also aware that the way that you behave with other people can affect their mood, it can affect their health. It affects so many different things. And then we realize that we can't be selfish. It's not just a sin in the religious sense. It's just absolutely illogical because it means that our world is less safe or our environment is less safe. And therefore it's actually inherently selfish to not be selfish because if we think, okay, I want to be safe, then I want everybody around me to be happy. I want everybody around me to be well and I want them to thrive. And that way, you know, nobody's going to come robbing me or create problems for me and all the other things that people, you know, who isolate themselves end up having. You know, this is something that people don't understand because they become more and more and more self-focused. You know, if you think of a super, super wealthy family who never really participates in society except on a very, very superficial level, they have less and less and less sense of how connected they are to the well-being of all these other people. So they only see them from afar. And it's like, that's not my problem, but it's very much your problem because if those people get ill, they bring illness to you. And if, you know, if they want to steal your stuff, then you're going to have to build a fortress around you to just live your life, you know? So it's all these things that we see that are so obvious once you become mindful. And that are not obvious when your only focus is yourself or on your own small little bubble, your own little world. And this is why we're in this situation, in these pandemics. In the Shastra, you have this, in fact, in Ayurveda, because Ayurveda and the Charaka Samhita, they talk about a pandemic. They talk about epidemics. So 3,000 years ago, you know, they're talking about the remedy for pandemics. The remedy is that the cause of the pandemic, according to the Shastra, is that the government is bad, that people are selfish, that the land is polluted, that people are not behaving properly, that people are not ethical. And all of these things were already an issue 3,000 years ago. It's a human thing. And when we pull ourselves off balance, when we're less and less mindful, this is what happens. It's not happening to us, it's happening because of us. And so when we start to understand this is just the way that the world works, when we live in harmony and balance, we're all well, we're all abundant, and we can all live happily. And then there's no fear, there's no stress, there's no, this is mine and that's, you know, that's not your, that's not my problem or whatever. So when we're truly mindful, this is part of the program. Mm-hmm. So it's not like just maintaining a nice, you know, energy and trying to calm yourself down and sleeping better and all the other things. It's really engaging in the broadest possible way so that you improve life for everyone. And in, you know, according to our means and according to our particular skill set, we do that in our own way. Not everybody will do the same thing, but you know, some people will be able to actually physically engage socially and do something. Other people will give money so that other people can afford to do something. Or some people will just pray and, you know, cultivate an atmosphere of peace at home so that that spreads out from the home. And this is the practice, you know. So the practice is it really about how you engage in every way. And then when we look at it from the point of the and we'll do an exercise around this so you can really start to pull yourself back into yourself when there's stress and all this chaos going around. But when you start to notice all of this, pandemic stress and the chaos that's coming from individuals in your life or from the media or colleagues or whatever, you can also be a listening and compassionate person and you know, recognize the suffering. And recognize that, you know, you also have your suffering and, you know, everybody is touching something in their suffering. But you don't have to engage with it in the sense that there's nothing to benefit to get upset about it or to, you know, to go towards the suffering or to even encourage other people to perpetuate their version of the drama. Because when you start to scale things back, and of course it's difficult when family members are ill. This is not the, it's not to say it's easy, but when somebody might be dying or somebody has died, but we pull it back to what is actually happening in this moment and how can I bring peace right now in this moment, which is the only place that will allow people to really heal. Because if we all start to pull out towards the drama, it just creates more and more and more drama. It's kind of like when somebody's angry, you know, when somebody's really upset and angry, you don't stand in their face and yell at them. You know, you start to become quieter, you start to become calmer, you're trying to pull them back down to a calm place. And it's the same for every emotion. When an emotion goes really, really chaotic, we have to be this kind of, well, we don't have to, we can choose to be this kind of source of calm and reason so that we recognize, yes, there is suffering. That's not the question. But what am I doing about the suffering? Am I adding more suffering to it? Or am I adding more upset and pain to this situation? Or am I allowing people to just breathe and be with what's going on? The Buddha called this the second arrow. So the first arrow, I think I mentioned this in an earlier session. And the first arrow is whatever happens. It's the pain, you know, it's like COVID. There's an illness. That's the first arrow. So yeah, that hurts. But the second arrow is what you do to yourself. That's the elaborate suffering and the emotional upset and all of the talking about it and extending and, you know, making it a bigger deal. And so you end up with this situation where we can manage the pain, we can deal with what the original pain is, but not if we add the second arrow and focus on that. If we focus on that suffering and we focus on the, you know, the hit, as it were, as if that were the problem, then we are lost once again. We're not mindful. So we recognize that suffering is part of life. That is one of the principal teachings of Buddhism. Life, if you're alive, you were even born in suffering. You know, if you're born, it hurt. The baby cries when it's born. It hurts. Life hurts. Once you're in this body, there's suffering. And that's the given. So it's like, okay, what do we do about that now? Everybody has their own version of suffering, right? And so that's part of this practice where you can come back to this place and you say, you can separate out, you say, what is the first arrow in this situation? And can I pull, or can I separate everything else that is not the first arrow so that I can focus in this moment on being practical, on being helpful, on really experiencing sadness? It's sad, but it doesn't have to become a story or a drama. You know, it's not like a soap opera. It's just sad in this moment, or it's stressful. And then we can recognize the stress. And we know that through breathing, instantly, within 30 seconds to a minute, you can completely change your biology. If you're stressed, if you're upset, the simple act of breathing slowly, breathing calmly, will completely change your emotional response and your physiological response. And so when you see people getting hysterical or extremely upset, you'll notice that they're not breathing. They're hyperventilating and they're not breathing properly. So for example, for people around you, you can invite them to just breathe a little bit deeper, you know, or for you yourself, if you're in this kind of ocean of upset, then the very first priority is just to take 3 or 4 really conscious, slow, deep breaths. You inhale as long as possible, you exhale as long as possible. And in that space, that just that little moment of changing your biology, changing your mind, then your reaction, the next thing you do is going to be much more grounded. It's going to be much wiser. And then you start to become this kind of rock, like a pillar that people around you can feel, okay, I can calm down because the energy is calming down. And we tend to imitate each other when we're with people, especially live, even online, it seems that we imitate each other. But when we're live together in the same room, people tend to pick up on each other's energy and mimic that energy. So if you want somebody to calm down, you just simply quietly slow your own breathing down. And you'll notice that as you do that, they adapt to that rhythm because we're kind of hardwired to connect with each other on that energetic level. And this is how the heart especially functions. Our heart engages with other people. And the rhythm of the heart will entrain, it matches the rhythm of other hearts around it. That's why it feels so good to be with people who are deeply calm and spiritual, like somebody like a guru or a Dalai Lama who's just spending their whole life in this kind of attitude. And you feel immediately you feel better because your heart picks up on their energy, their heart. And so we can try and at least accomplish that at home. So what we did last week, I'd like to build on for today. That breathing practice is a central practice to understanding your own mind. In mindfulness, the idea is that you have these four pillars, which is the body, the breath, the mind, or the way that you think, and then the things that go on around you, the environment around you. And so we want to be able to understand at any time what's going on in any of those places. So we do, for example, the evening practice that you were doing, the body scan. You can do that anytime. You know, you get in the car, you have to go somewhere, you know, to prepare yourself for wherever you're going and to arrive in a state that's fresh and engaged, then you do the body scan. Just check how do I feel? What's going on? Am I breathing? How is my stomach? Am I digesting? You know, do I feel tension in my hands or in my neck or anything? And you just do that. It takes maybe 30 seconds. Once you got used to it, you just go whoosh down through the body, check it out. And it's like resetting the clock. And then the second thing is you focus on your breath and you come into the breath and you change your attention, your whole focus. It goes from this outer driven attention towards, you know, the sensory things, all the sights and the sounds and everything else. And you pull it all back in. This is pratyahara, that you're pulling all the sense awarenesses back in and you bring it back to your breath. And this is why the breath is so powerful, because it's always available as a source of attention, as a thing that you can immediately come back to. And when you do that as a practice, it becomes second nature. Then you know, in this moment, I have complete control over how I'm reacting in this moment, over what is going on in my mind. So you don't allow the mind to get carried away. Or if it gets carried away, it doesn't go as far as it used to. You know, that you say, oh, wait a minute, the mind is going all over the place. I'm going to pull it back and come back to my breath. Bring the mind's attention. It's like training a puppy. You just come back to this moment. You know, the puppy's going to run away. It's going to do his thing. No, I want you to come and sit. That's all you have to do. And you just keep repeating it. And that practice, once you feel comfortable with it, it is a lifesaver. It is truly something that will change your life. And it seems for the mind, which is used to being busy, and it's the nature of the mind to be thinking all the time and doing stuff all the time, it seems like torture for the mind. And so the mind is going to do everything in the beginning, especially to pull your attention away. And even over time, it depends on what's going on in your life. There are times when it's a little more difficult, at times when it's a little more relaxed. And so your mind will always challenge you to pay attention to something else. It'll find something else. Oh, there was a noise. What's the noise? Or, you know, there's what's going on in the kitchen, you know, something. And so the idea is to just keep saying, what is happening now in this moment? I know I'm breathing in. That's what I absolutely know for sure. And all of the rest of what's going on is a product of the mind. It's a thought. So even COVID, it's a thought. It's not actually happening, if you think about it. There's a virus. We live surrounded by virus. We always have. For billions of years, this planet has contained bacteria and virus. We are 98% bacteria. That's how we're even alive. And there's just suddenly now a lot of talk about this thing. And so when we start to, that's what I mean about like pulling back as much as possible and seeing what is true in this situation, what is real in this situation. And if it's a situation where somebody is ill or somebody is dying, bring it as close into that situation as possible. What in this moment is happening? What can I do? You know, how can I help this person? Or how can I even help that person calm down? Because then the upset is, the second arrow is more problematic than the first arrow. And that's actually what's happening with COVID. The first arrow, COVID, is one thing. But the nonsense that's going on around COVID is the second arrow. And it's got the whole world completely turned upside down. To the extent that, you know, we're when we lose that sense of what is real and what grounds us, we also lose our capacity to think clearly. And so people are behaving irrationally. You know, like last year, especially in the West, everybody was like buying in enormous quantities of food and toilet paper and things like that. It's like, are you insane? What do you think? So there's a virus. It's not like nobody's gonna make toilet paper anymore. And there's always water. Like, what's the problem? So, you know, this is the mind just goes into this whole unreal space. And that's why you have to keep practicing coming back to the breath. What in this moment is real? You come back to that fundamental point of reality, which is, I know I'm breathing in. This much I know. And all the rest, I don't know. I'm not sure. And so as long as I'm not sure, I can relax a little bit. I can keep a space for saying, this is not really what is going on. It is a story about what is going on. And each person has their personal perspective or angle or suffering that they're bringing into the story. And do I need to engage with that? Is that something that I should involve myself with? And so this is where mindfulness will really save you. It saves you, and it makes you in many, many ways a better person. It makes you somebody who actually is clear and responsible and wise. And then you start to realize that actually I can handle all of this stuff, because 98% of it is the story about the thing that's going on. And the 2% that is real, I can manage. I can do something about that. And you know, it applies to anything, but of course it's good in these kind of conditions where you can really apply it directly in these moments of suffering. And there is loss. You know, this is the other truth that we have to acknowledge, is that life is about loss. It's about suffering and losing each other. If we were born, we're going to die. We don't get to decide when. And so when we understand the notion, the true notion of non-attachment, it doesn't mean you don't love somebody. because we do. But if that love is just a kind of an open and free love, then you're not attached to the person being there or not. You know, at this point, you start to realize, well, we're all going to go. And it's not up to me to decide that I like it or I don't like it. And if I decide that I don't like it and I'm going to suffer, well, I'm also not only harming that person who is dying or, you know, or even dead, so that their suffering is increased by worrying about me now, or I'm even harming myself mentally and physically because I'm so emotional about this loss. And so when we can come to terms with this, if we look at that bigger picture, as mindfulness does, we're not just pulling out in terms of what's going on today, but we're pulling out in terms of humanity, what has always happened. We're mm-hmm. always coming and going in these cycles of life and suffering and so on. The Buddha told a story of a woman who became a disciple of his later, whose child died, and she was so upset that she couldn't see that her child had died. And so she was hysterical. She kept asking the villagers to send her to a doctor and you know, find a doctor that will help her child, even though the child had already died. And finally, somebody sent her to the Buddha. And when she explained that she was extremely upset because her child died, she said, "Have you got a cure? Can you help me stop this pain?" And the Buddha said, "Yes, you have to get a mustard seed. So you'll have to find a mustard seed from anybody in your village that has not experienced death. When you can bring that back, then I can cure your child." And so she goes knocking on all these doors and says, "You know, did you experience death in your family?" "Of course, yes, of course." And she keeps going and going and going, desperate for that mustard seed. And then finally she realized what the teaching was. And she finally realized that this is just the way it is. And we don't get some kind of special priority treatment, you know, because we don't like things a particular way. And so we have to then decide in that moment, I have to come back to this moment and live this life, live just now. And it doesn't mean that we're not attached and, you know, loving and we won't regret or we won't feel sadness when we lose somebody. But it doesn't have to mean destroying our lives, you know. And so we have to, especially in these crisis times, we have to try and keep that frame of mind that allows us to keep a big, big picture of what's going on. And the only way to keep that really big picture view is to be really close to yourself. So this paradox of focus, inward focus on the breath, coming back to what is absolutely happening in this moment, is the solution for all of this outer chaos that seems to be huge, but it's in fact only a story. Okay, so before we go on to the practice, do you want
to, I wanted to say, definitely, I think every situation during the day, I try and keep a bit of a conscious filter around me of how am I behaving, how am I responding, do I take a pause, do I immediately go into the situation and react, and of course, in retrospective, I say I could have done better, you know, things like that. I think again, you're basically going against the brain, you know. You are basically challenging your old habits of responding.
Yeah.
Which are so powerful, which are so is like instantly comes from subconscious mind and it just happens, you know. And there is a situation around you which requires immediate response. Yeah. Because otherwise, your brain also knows that if you don't respond, they will all perceive you a dumb person. You know?
That's an idea, you see? So that's an idea, and you don't know.
Yeah. Because that's how they have also seen you. So that's how they also expect the response.
But you see that's a trap that you have created for yourself now. So I want to stop on this because this is really important. This is the nature of the mind. The mind creates its own traps. And then it says, "You see how I can't change?" It's the way that the mind is like a spoiled child. It asks for attention all the time. It wants your attention because it's the nature of the mind to think. And so its only value, according to the mind, is in that thinking. But when you're in the pause, when you're in the space of peace, where there's just a gap between thoughts, short or long, then there's a real connection to who you really are beyond all of these thoughts. And so when you challenge those thoughts, you must challenge all of them, by the way. You really have to go through and you pick them all out and you say, is that true? How do I know it's true? And who could I be if that weren't true? Mm-hmm. And then you start to notice that actually here I am worried about what other people think. And I can promise you two things. One is that you will never, ever know what somebody thinks. Never. It's just not even possible. Even if they tell you what they think, it's not really what they were thinking. So you don't know ever. And the second thing is that 98% of what people are thinking is about them, not about you. And this is one truth that is really helpful to remember, that people are most often thinking about themselves, their own selfish lives and needs and interests, and they might be giving you a fragment of their attention. So while you're worried about organizing yourself and doing the things that you think other people want of you, rather than just being you, you're creating this whole box that you have to push yourself back into each time. And it may not even be close to the truth. And it certainly won't bring out anything of any value for you because you're constantly self-censoring, you know. And that censor, that censor is the same part of you that feels frustration and wants to even do these courses. So you see that that's this double-edged sword. It's like, okay, well, if I continue to believe that, there will be guaranteed suffering. Because I'm, again, believing something that is not reliable, it's not factual, it's not based in anything but my belief. And my beliefs are things that I should question constantly. Don't believe everything your mind tells you, because most of it is crap. It's not believable. And so once you start to practice this, you start to really be able to feel this is easy. This is so much better. If I can just let that go, let go of somebody else's opinion, because opinions are not truth. It's just an idea. And that idea is based on conditioning, and it's based on education, and it's based on, again, these social constraints that we all put ourselves into. And it's super boring. It's incredibly stifling. And it'll always bring out some kind of neurosis. It'll always bring out some kind of problem. It'll never make a person feel good. So you can change the pattern, and you change that pattern from yourself. So question everything. Don't allow yourself to believe what you think and say, is that true? Just a thought comes, you say, is that a reliable thought? Is that something that I should invest in? Or is that something I can discard as unknowable? It's an unknowable, you know, and if something's unknowable, we have to let it go, because then you're operating based on something that might be wrong. So far better to just do the thing that you know is right in this circumstance. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is transformational, not just for you, but for the people around you. And if you continue to worry about what other people's expectations are for you, you're absolutely not living your life. You never will, because your life is then completely dependent on what you think you know about what other people expect of you. Instead of just simply doing the thing that's right.
But if other people's perception of you or what they think of you is also something that if does not change, then you are not being, as example, some of the decisions or some of the things that you're doing also depends on the people around you, you know?
Yeah.
They don't think rightly of you, or they're carrying some impressions in their head. Then, for example, you have a boss. If he does not see you rightly, he will not give you, he will not give you right, increment, or like, you know, you're dependent on someone whose impression is important, because they decide your future, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of whether you will be
promoted.
That's
the choice you make, by the way. You have to understand that, okay? So you better to say, I allow somebody else to decide my future. And so therefore, I'm in this situation. So you see how you have to understand it that way, because there is no absolute in this sense. It's always a choice. I am choosing this, and this is what I think, you know, is going on, and therefore this is the consequence. And so when you, the other thing to keep in mind, so there's three things. So the one thing is that we can never know what somebody's thinking, ever. including your boss. Second thing is 90% of the time, it's not about you for sure. It's about them. And the third thing is that their opinion of you, what they think of you, is none of your business. It's entirely projected from their own experience and has very little to do with what is true about you. And so all you can control, because you can't control any of that, you can't control their opinion about you. The only thing that you can control is your sense of what is right and wrong. This is your dharma. This is when you're acting according to dharma, when you're doing the right thing in the moment, you're doing the thing that is just, that is fair, you're doing exactly what you need to be doing. And the consequences, you let go.
What was the first thing you said? You will never know what the other person...
Number one, you will never know what another person is thinking, truly.
Okay, what? Okay.
Number two is that you will, you can be sure that 98%, the vast majority of what they're thinking is about themselves and not about you. People just don't spend that much time thinking about other people.
Vast majority.
And then the third one is you cannot control somebody's opinion about you. So you could say literally their opinion of me is not my business. It's up to them. They alone are responsible for what they think and believe. And I can control what I do. I can control my words, my actions. And this is indeed the only thing that you can control. So you can do your best. You do the right thing, you know, and in that sense, then you are doing you are walking that path mindfully to do the right thing, and you allow the consequences to take care of themselves. But otherwise you end up in this game of cat and mouse where there's this kind of manipulation going on. And then there's this kind of, it gets a bit slimy because then nobody is sincere. And there's nothing more appealing, nothing more confidence inspiring than somebody who is 100% sincere and who's not trying to do something to please another. You know, people pleasing will always end up in suffering. Because if you're trying to make another person happy, you will always be compromising a part of yourself. And to a certain extent, of course, socially, we have to do that. You know, if people drop in and it's like the wrong time, you say, well, of course you can come in, have a drink, even if you don't want that. But that's, you know, those are minor social issues. But when your people pleasing is really compromising your life, when it's really compromising who you are, and you don't even feel like you can be yourself, then the question is, okay, why am I choosing this? This is a choice I have to recognize, and why am I choosing this?
Mm-hmm. So focusing on what other people think, of course, that is not in your control, because of course, if you are focusing on self and your own demeanor, your own behavior is, of course, that will indirectly change their perception of you.
Absolutely. If they see that you're doing the right thing, that also your actions speak louder than words, right? Everybody's actions always speak louder than words. You can easily say what you like, but how you behave, how you are, is what people notice. And they notice that sometimes in unusual moments, like they see that you're doing the right thing and that was not even related to work. You know, you're doing this thing and they're like, wow, that's impressive. I didn't know that about this person. You know, so when you're doing the right thing from the heart and you're doing the thing, like there's some guy apparently in UP who is selling refills for oxygen tanks at 1 rupee. You know, he can do 1,000 tanks a day in his factory. He's selling them for 1 rupee. Everybody else is charging 30,000 rupees. So that's the right thing to do. You see, when somebody is acting justly, some good consequence is going to come from that. He is doing his dharma. He's got the material. He's got the capacity. He's got the wherewithal to do it. And he says, I know suffering. I'm going to do this. You see, and then, so he's just jumped in. He's not standing around wondering, would this be a good thing to do? He just jumps in because he can. This is where we start to use mindfulness in a very practical way, okay? But what you were saying earlier about this, you know, it's difficult because your mind gets pulled this direction and that direction, and then we react to things. That is why practice is absolutely necessary. And if you practice, you will already be able to pull yourself back in those moments, or at the very latest, you know, like when you're in the moment, you see something's going the wrong direction, you pull yourself back, rather than getting deep in the hole and having to kind of dig your way back out. So what I suggest is that we've got about 10 minutes now, we use these last 10 minutes for practice, and that you can really use this opportunity as a chance to really discover what it's like to play with the mind, okay? What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop this recording.